We're going to bring the meeting to order. And we had a quorum. A couple of them have gone for coffee. Ah, there now we're back. We have the minutes. Representative Cornish moves approval of the minutes of March 10th. Any additions or corrections? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Minutes are approved. First on our agenda today, because it's not on the first on the agenda, but first I'm going to hear is Representative Anderson. Representative Anderson, we have House File 1740. Not only do you have the seniority to be first, but you have you brought the people from the longest distance. So,
I have two amendments, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Members, I'll move House File 1740 be recommended to pass and refer to local government. And I assume these amendments are to get the bill into the order that you want?
That's correct, Mr. Okay. Chairman.
I'll first move Amendment 0858. It's being passed out, members. You'll get that in just a moment. I would get the bill into the order that the author desires. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Bill is amended. Also have an unnumbered amendment that's coming around. It says page 4, line 1. I'll move that amendment also. This, again, this is to get the bill in. Mr. Helen, can you explain that particular one to me?
It should have been all one amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Should have been all one amendment?
We'll
just incorporate. That's, we can understand that. Because I don't believe the other one really is. One is just kind of placing it in the bill, I believe,
yeah.
In the language. So we move the correct amendment, and your bill is now amended. And Representative Anderson?
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity to appear before your committee. House File 1740 is a bill that modifies payments to county for natural resource land. I have with me this morning two gentlemen from Lake Woods County, Todd Bechtel and Wayne Bredesen, and I'd like to have them explain the bill to you.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Wayne Bendixson. I'm the county assessor / land commissioner for Lake of the Woods County. And I'll try and explain LUP lands. It's short for Land Utilization Project. These were lands where people were settled in the forest south of Bedette and Warroad. Oh, back in, actually started in the turn of the century, and the federal government said, well, we're not too keen on bringing services way down the forest. I mean, you might have somebody living on 140, and 2 miles away might be somebody else. So instead of providing services, because then the rural electrification was coming in at that time, so they decided to see if these people would sell their land and they would move them closer to a village or what have you. So they bought these lands from willing sellers, and there are a few that did not want to sell that is still in private hands. But most of these lands were bought in the late 30s, anywhere from probably 36, 39. So then the federal government made a contract with the state of Minnesota that they would manage these lands as wildlife management units, and it's about 81,000 acres. And since 1940, that's the way these lands have been managed. So, and all the receipts, we do not get any timber receipts from these lands. The timber receipts go to Norris Camp, which is the headquarters for this area in the management of this land and the Concon lands that we have up there, which is a considerable number. So all the receipts go there, and we are currently receiving approximately 46, 47 cents an acre for these lands, and we would like them treated as acquired lands, the same as Concon lands are now treated as acquired lands, because these lands are managed the same as those lands. So that is one of the reasons we like it treated, these lands treated the same as WMA lands. And the private lands next to these lands pay about $4.35 an acre taxes. So, and we are about 75% plus tax, or not tax exempt actually, because we do get built on some of the land, but we are 75% government owned as far as the county goes. So as you can see, we the tax base is rather limited. But so that is a brief history on LUP lands, or land utilization project. I forgot to mention that the lease was for 50 years. It started in 1940. It was up in 1990. Since then, they have renewed the lease, and it was effective in 99 with a 10-year renewal. So the next lease will be in 2009. So that is about as much as I can give you right now, or Todd wants to say anymore.
Todd Beckel, thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's a large section of land. I mean, when you start talking 81,700 acres, you know, that's three quarters the size of Ramsey County. So for that chunk of land, and right now with our payment in lieu of 46 cents, it only comes out to be about $37,000 is what the counties get to use or receive off of this 81,000 acres. It's, you know, when you supply fire protection, police protection, rescue protection, it doesn't go very far.
Yeah. You have additional testimony? Or is that?
That's all, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Is there questions from members? This is, I believe, according to the fiscal note, we're looking at if this would go into effect. I believe do we have an effective date on the bill?
I think it would be effective in 2005, Chairman.
The way it's written, it says right at the effective date after final enactment, but which we wouldn't want it to impact on this.
We have a DNR person here. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Paul Pojar. I work for the Department of Natural Resources, Lands and Minerals Section. The question was regarding the effective date. I was under the assumption that this would be effective on August 1st, like many policy bills. I've been told by Revenue that it would be effective, however, on July 1st, because it has an appropriation attached to it. The monies to make the tilt payments come from the general fund as an open appropriation. The payments are made on July 20th each year, and so if the effective date is July 1st, there would be a payment this year following enactment. However, in order to make that July payment, we have to certify acreages and values of lands to the Department of Revenue, which actually cuts the check for this payment. We have to make that certification in March of this year. So we're in the process of providing them with that information right now. So the next reasonable period after whichever effective date this bill would have, either July 1st or August 1st, the next opportunity that we would have to certify land, acreage, and value would be next March, which would be a July 2005 payment, which is a fiscal 06 appropriation. Does that help out, Mr. Chairman?
That's the reason why the fiscal note is identifying $281,000 in fiscal year 06.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Currently, these lands are paid at about 50 cents or so an acre, as was mentioned earlier. The payment would rise to about $3.85 or so an acre. So the difference between the current payment and the payment if this bill passes would be about $3.30 an acre difference, which adds up to the $280,000 in fiscal 06 and $288,000, I believe it is, in fiscal 07.
And can you give me some history as to why this has been treated differently than the Concon lands? Just because it was established first? Or?
Mr. Chairman, members, we were at a hearing before the Senate, and the chair of that committee was advised by their fiscal analyst people that the LUP lands were considered late in the discussion regarding the Concon lands, and in order to meet the targets that were established to try to meet the elevation of the payments to Concon lands, they couldn't do it with the LUP worked into it, and so the LUP were dropped out. The lands are managed in a very similar way. They're intermingled. Concon lands are next to LUP lands in some cases. They're both managed for wildlife purposes. For all intents and purposes, they're pretty much the same.
When we have, during our budget shortfall situation, did we fund the Concon lands fully?
Mr. Chairman, yes, they were funded fully. Again, Mr. Chair, it's an open appropriation, and so as a result, didn't have to have any special legislation, and none was proposed or passed last year that I'm aware of.
Yeah. All right. Well, it, as I'm adding this up here for the biennium, next biennium would be about $569,000.
Mr. Chairman, yes, that sounds about right.
And that is taken into account, that's subtracting the dollars that we're already committed to it?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. What we did is we took the difference between the current payment and the payment as would occur under if this law were passed, or if this bill were passed into law. And it's the $281,000 and the $288,000 for those two different fiscal year payments were the difference between the payment levels.
And right now, that difference between 47 cents an acre and $3 an acre.
I can give you last year, Mr. Chairman, I can give you last year's numbers. Last year, the acquired payments were at $3.72.9 per acre for the acquired land. And they were 46.5 cents for the LUP lands. So the difference between that would be about $3.30 or so per acre. Okay.
Questions, Representative Cornish?
I just wanted to say, Mr. Chair, that this is a good thing. I used to live up in that area, and one of the biggest rubs in the local governments up there was the money for LUPs and PLTs and the payment that they or inadequate, and anything we can do to remedy that situation would be good.
To give me a little better idea of the LUP land with regard to how they're managed, what is the differences between their current management and ConCon management? I know ConCon has some, we had to do some special legislation to get ATV trails in there and some other things like that. Is this restricted with regard to recreational use in any way, or what's, how is they managed differently?
Mr. Chairman, I believe the two are managed very much the same on the ground. The only difference between them would be that under the ConCon, the state owns those lands outright, and under the LUP lands, there is a lease from the federal government for those lands. And so there may be some different reporting types of things that the DNR has to do to satisfy the federal government that we're managing their lands as the lease calls for. But as I understand it, they're handled in very, very much the same way as for wildlife purposes. There is timber cutting that takes place on both ConCon and LUP lands, and that timber cutting is done to enhance the wildlife, as opposed to in other areas of the state where it's done for economic purposes of reforestation and that kind of thing.
Are there any funds generated off these lands?
Mr. Chair, the funds that are generated off the lands are from timber cutting. On these particular lands, there's a difference between these particular lands and ConCon lands in that on ConCon lands, we often have gravel leases. On this particular type of land, LUP, there are no gravel leases as it's part of the lease that said gravel shall be used, if it's used, shall be used for management of this particular area as opposed to sale to local users, for example.
And are there trust fund lands involved in this area at all? Because it's federal land, it's, I don't know how that works.
Mr. Chairman, I would suspect that there is probably a scattering of trust fund lands. As you're aware, we receive from the federal government school trust fund lands, Section 16 and 36 in each township. And I would suspect that within an area this large, there is a scattering of trust fund lands, but no large block of lands that I'm aware of.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Just as a note, in 98, 99, and 2000 fiscal year, the net receipts on LUP land, I don't have the latest 3 years. This came from the DNR Forestry in Bedette. The total take in those 3 years was $726,365, which is divided between or how they manage, it goes to, like I said, Norris Camp, which manages these lands, and they receive this, and we do not receive any timber proceeds from this. Unlike the ConCon land, we get half the timber proceeds.
All right. So you don't get a share of the timber?
We don't share any, because it goes to the management of the LUP lands. So the federal government, they work it out so they come out even, put it that way. So, and if anybody is interested, I have a copy of the first lease and of the last lease, but if anybody wants to.
Okay.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions from members? Do we represent McNamara?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a follow-up to your same question. I'm trying to understand, and my question was going to be about the logging and the receipts for that. Can you tell me how they're treated differently than the ConCon lands? Logging happens in both, and where the actual receipts go in how you're treated differently than the con- I understand in the funding of the 47 cents and the $3, but did you also say there is a difference in how the logging receipts are treated for you?
Well, we have DNR answer that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, in accordance with the laws of the state of Minnesota dealing with ConCon lands, the statutes call for the sharing of any income generated from the land. So if there's a timber cut or there's a sand and gravel lease on ConCon lands, the income received is shared between the state, the general fund, and the counties. So 50-50. On the LUP lands, because we don't own them, we lease them from the federal government. As a condition of that lease, the income generated off that land is to be spent on the management of those lands. And so there is no split. The entirety of the income generated goes to the management of those lands.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative McNair.
Thank you. So you're comfortable. I just wanted to be sure that wasn't another difference in them. I understand the $3 and the 47 cents difference, but in the logging, because it's actual title held by the federal government, the money is used in the land. That's not another shortcoming that you're experiencing. It's treated level. Would I be fair? You said the receipts of the part that you don't get given to you, but they get to be used on the land. Is that kind of a... Maybe I'd mess that up worse than where you were at before.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's correct. The income that's generated off LUP lands is spent on the management of those lands. On the ConCon lands, the management of those lands, if they're being managed for forestry, for example, forestry receives an appropriation from the legislature to do its business out on the land. And so that's how that would be funded.
One last follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Right.
So if I was somebody from the suburbs of the Twin Cities and I took a ride up into your county or a ride up into Representative Pennis's county, would these lands look similar to me, ConCon, and these lands, would they look any different to me, and would they hold any different wildlife, or they're going to look the same to me, but you're treated differently in your funding? Is that the bottom line?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the ConCon lands, the way they were acquired by the state, were primarily associated with drainage. And so they were primarily, and this is a real generalization, they were primarily a wetland. The LUP lands were lands that were settled by people, farmers, that tried to eke out a living. And so those were more of the upland areas. So I guess if pressed to give a generalization, the LUP lands are a little bit drier than the ConCon lands, but from a perspective of habitat, they're similar. Okay.
I would assume that the revenues that are generated go into the general fund, and then the land is then managed. So it's not really a dollar for dollar management, or is it clearer cut than that? Do we put that into a dedicated fund somehow that's really dedicated to managing that land? I understand that the management is the outcome from the revenues generated, but do those revenues actually go to the general fund, and we just manage the land, and whatever it costs is what we cover, whether that's more or less? It's not really contingent upon that revenue that's generated, is it? Or
Mr. Chairman, I wish I were in a position to really answer your question. I think that it probably should be directed to someone in forestry. We do have somebody that can answer your question. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Ed Bogus from the Wildlife Section of DNR, and the revenue from these lands does go into a dedicated account that is used for those lands, but it isn't the only money that's used for managing those lands. We do put other money into management.
Okay. Is So that the actual management cost of the land is more than what the what is generated by the timber sale.
Mr. Chairman, yes, that's true.
Yeah. All right. Other questions for members? Is there additional testimony, especially from DNR, on this? Any recommendations? Is this supported by DNR or Representative Anderson? Do you know if they have a position on this?
Mr. Chairman, this is what we're talking about is increasing the pilt rates. And as far as the DNR is concerned, this is totally within your scope of decision making. We merely keep track of the acreages and the values of the land and do the computations for the payments.
Okay. So the department's neutral on it, I assume.
That's a neutral.
That's better than having them opposed. any other questions for members? This members, so you realize this bill will be going to local government for their review, and then it will be going to taxes, and the real decision will be made in taxes as to as a payment in lieu of taxes that we're really talking about. For as far as the fiscal impact, Mr. Reinholz, can you tell me as to does this become part of our budget then eventually, or how does this actually, because it's an open end appropriation, how does that work?
Mr. Chairman, members, this appropriation is an open appropriation. It does show up in the DNR budget. So, yes, it would be tracked by this department, this committee.
And how does that work with regard to targets and that sort of thing? Something that would be in a future,
Mr. Chairman,
be accounted in a future target?
Mr. Chairman, we have not received targets for this session. We typically do receive a target that includes the next biennium, so we would have to account for this expenditure in that target, I assume.
So unless that target was increased, this amount would actually decrease something else within the budget. Is that correct?
This committee would have to take action to decrease something else to stay within the target. That is the way I would interpret it. If this was passed, this is an open appropriation, it would happen. If it was passed on by this committee from their action, we would have to account for it and either have target increased dollars or make an offsetting reduction somewhere else.
And is there any fiscal impact for this biennium? So we're talking everything is in the future or the next biennium, is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, we do have a fiscal note that was prepared by the Department of Natural Resources and the Revenue Department. It has not yet been signed off by Finance, but I do believe it is accurate and it indicates no fiscal effects until fiscal year 06 and beyond. So there is nothing listed for the current biennium.
And we had some amendments earlier, or actually an amendment, and I'm just trying to make sure that I have it all included. As there was the second one that you handed me, Representative Anderson, actually starts on page 4, and there's I'm wondering on if we are... It says deleting the and deleting new language and reinstating the stricken language, and I think because it's actually calling for some separate action, I should probably take a vote on that just to make sure we have that officially included.
That's
and
then,
rather than trying to incorporate it into the, I should have incorporated it into the original amendment, but I didn't before I took the vote. So, members, there the unnumbered amendment before you has. Page 4, line 1, would be the amendment, which just is taking out the new language and inserting the existing language. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Now I'm certain that we have it amended as you requested, Representative Anderson. And it's my only frustration is to know where the money is going to be able to come from. And
it's a question of fairness, Mr. Chairman.
I understand.
Get the Concon lands, get money. Why not the LRP lands?
Yeah, it's. Wish I had the answer to how we could deal with this. It's kind of like making our own poison here. We want to have it, or medicine, really. It's kind of trying to fix something, but at the same time, it's not going to be a painless fix for the state. It'll certainly help that area of the state. Have to figure out how it's going to fit into the future. I'm kind of torn myself on this one as to how to actually deal with this at this time. It's going to go to, it'll eventually end up in taxes, so I think
That's
we'll
right.
probably, from a policy standpoint, I think if this committee agrees that this is the right thing to do, we pass it on to local government and the others, and we'll work with those committees to see how it can be worked out fiscally. If that's, are there any other suggestions? Any other testimony from the audience, either for or against this provision? Okay, the motion is renewed on House File 1740. You're recommended to pass and be referred to local government as amended. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. You're very welcome.
Thank you.
Next, we'll have Representative Tingelsted, House File 2405.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 2405 be considered for the omnibus finance bill.
Representative Tingelsted, so moved. Representative Tingelsted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, House File 2405. This is a bill that comes to us through the Legislative Commission on Minnesota Resources, and it's kind of a procedural thing that we see every 2 years here in this committee. Basically, what this does is it, through the LCMR projects, they're recommended for a two-year funding period, and generally most of the projects are pretty short, usually 2 to 3 years, and the way the appropriation language is written, it's fairly tight so that the money's only available during that time period. But what sometimes happens is there's, for various reasons, projects cannot fit within that two-year time period, so they come back to us with just this minor adjustment for kind of timing reasons. And in the bill today is four different projects. On line 14, it mentions the Mesabi Trail. Line 18, the Gateway Trail Bridge. 2122 is the Buckthorn project, and on the back, line one is the wildlife habitat corridors. And with me today from LCMR is Susan Von Mosch to talk about the details of the project. And like I said, this is a fairly minor procedural thing that we see every couple years in this committee.
Okay. Any other testimony? Yeah. Any questions? Hey, Representative Tingelsted, what I believe I'm going to do is lay this over for inclusion in the omnibus supplemental omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Okay. House File 2405 is laid over for inclusion in the omnibus bill. The next is Representative Poppy, House File 2368.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House File 2368, and we have an amendment.
Okay. House File 2368 is moved and will be referred to the General Register. Your amendment?
The amendment is should be in everybody's packet. It's A041084.
Okay, Representative Poppy moves that amendment to get the bill into the form you would like. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As everybody probably knows by now, the what we're doing with this amendment is taking last year's Game and Fish Bill, the 2003 version, and amending it on and combining it with this year's to create one big giant Game and Fish Bill. And Mr. Chair, if you'd like, I can go through all of the provisions of the amendment or go through the whole bill.
I think you should cover the subject area just in very general nature. But
okay. I'll go through the amendment. First, we start off with adding mourning doves to the list of game birds in Minnesota. Next, we're adding in the class of unprotected birds, we're adding the Eurasian collared dove, which the DNR considers an invasive species and a nuisance. The next sections cover game, allowing the commissioner of the DNR to make a game refuge into a wildlife sanctuary. I'm sorry, we're not quite at that section. Allows the commissioner to make a game refuge if more than 50% of the area is in public ownership, at least 640 acres bordering or contiguous to marsh or body of water or water course. The next is kind of the same thing, except it's only a portion of a land area. Then we get to the sanctuary, subdivision 4 under section 5, where county residents can petition to establish in public waters a game refuge. Under section 6, subdivision 1, the sanctuary, where the commissioner can make any part of state game refuge a sanctuary where there would be no trespassing except under very strict limited conditions during the waterfowl hunting season. So no hunting, no trespassing, no anything. Next section under section 7, subdivision 2, sort of the same thing, but this is a waterfowl feeding and resting area. The difference here is that there is some trespass allowed with boats that I believe are under 30 horsepower. Section 8, subdivision 4, covers hearings for game and fish offenses. And what we're trying to do here in the language that's added is unlawfully taken, possessed, or transported wild animals with a restitution value of over $500, just trying to tighten up the poaching statutes. Moving down to Section 9, Subdivision 4A, this is again more regulatory or more legal changes, and what it's saying is that if someone doesn't appear in court, that they can have their hunting and fishing privileges taken away from them. And I think what the DNR is trying to do here is restrict non-resident hunters that come to Minnesota and take much larger limits of or over limits of walleyes or northerns or other fish with them out of the state. It gives them something of a mechanism to go after those people. Then we move into the turkey license section. And this one was somewhat controversial last year. I think we worked out all of the bugs in the turkey license part. Essentially what it's saying under the separate selection process for turkey licenses is that any license issued under that subdivision will require the person getting the license to hunt on their own land. Subdivision 12, Mike Nelson's part of this, the youth deer license. It just changes all it's doing is adding the words or archery to this issue where it's allowing a resident under the age of 16 to have a license but not necessarily a tag. And we've been able to do that with firearms. This adds the words or archery. Moving down to section 16, we're looking at shooting hours, hunting hours in this section. And the big change here is the change to the opening day only of the waterfowl season. Typically, waterfowl hunting in Minnesota starts a half an hour before sunrise. On opening day, it's always been a noon, well, not always, for several years, it's been a noon opener. This would change that to 9 a.m. It would also require a study, which I believe is due in 2005, looking at the effects, if any, of this on the waterfowl populations in the state. Section 17, big game hunting, hunting bears with hounds. Section 20, another mourning dove part earlier we made mourning doves. The DNR is requested to make that a game bird, and here we're prescribing the commissioner to have a season for mourning doves, and then requiring hunters to have a license for it. Moving down, there's more turkey hunting license requirements under Section 21. What this does is allow an unlicensed adult who's 18 or older to accompany a youth hunter that does have a license. The idea here being that turkey hunting is a somewhat of a learned sport, and hoping to help youth, you know, have the adult help guide them or teach them, or maybe help with the turkey calling, which is an acquired skill. Going to the last page, Section 23, I think I already covered this, but it's requiring requiring there to be the commissioner to have a report coming back to this committee and the Senate committee about the changes in shooting hours as far as waterfowl goes, and then the report on the mourning dove season, which I didn't mention before, but would require also a report to see how successful or unsuccessful a mourning dove season would be. And I believe that's it, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to answer any questions, should there be any.
Yeah. I was wondering, some Poppy, because of some of the changes that you have in there, and establishing a new hunting opportunity, there's usually some costs that are associated with that. Have you talked to the chair of Ways and Means as to whether he's going to want to see this bill or not? I know that your desire to have this go on the general register, but normally this would go to Ways and Means first.
I have not talked to Chairman Knobloch for Ways and Means, and I don't know. I guess if Mr. Bogus was here, I'd have him come down. And I'm not aware that there were going to be any additional cost to this. But
Representative Hacker.
Mr. Chairman, I have talked to Representative Knobloch about this. In a couple of different ways. There is a bill that we've passed that had a mourning dove stamp attached to it, and that is in Representative Knobloch's committee. I talked to him about this issue before we moved this bill to the floor. This amendment is a bill that's on the floor, and he did not need to see it.
Okay.
Thank you, Representative Hackbar.
All right. Mr. Bogus, is there any cost for this has already gone directly to the floor, I believe, so we probably addressed that question before.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we've not identified additional costs. We would incorporate it into our rulemaking and season setting and enforcement that we do for the other seasons.
Okay. Any questions on Representative Hoppe's proposal? Representative Wozniak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the bear hunting provision, was that heard in policy committee?
It was in, this bill was House File 789. That was last year's Game and Fish bill. It was in last year's bill. It was Representative Howell's bill. We heard that bill last year during the session in policy, and it was amended or rolled into last year's Game and Fish bill. When we heard that this year to put it back on the general register, it was still in there, but I don't believe there was any discussion about bears at that time. But we're happy to have your support. Thank you, Representative Wozniak.
Mr. Chair, quite frankly, there's some provisions in here that I like, but my understanding of the bear hunting provision, to me, does not constitute sportsmen. And it's for some rather well-to-do folks who go into a camp, and they have the hounds chase the bear up a tree, pull in, probably on ATVs, go up, and shoot the bear out of the tree. And to me, that's not sportsman. And, based on really on that provision, I can't support your bill. I just don't see that as a sportsman. For someone who's trudged through a few sloughs and bogs going for elusive ducks and geese, I just don't see this as a good policy for the state of Minnesota for very exclusive club of folks who are going to, take bear in this manner. I don't think it's good policy for the state, so I'm going to have to oppose your bill based on that.
Okay. Other questions? Representative
Dill? I don't think there's anyone in here that thinks that I'm one of the most avid hunters in the state. But this section bothers me about the dogs being used to trail bears and for the taking of bears. I recently saw a show on the Outdoor Channel where some hunters in the western part of the United States were in a suburban, and they had their dogs released and had radio telemetry on the dogs. They let the dogs out and then drove up and down a gravel road. After an hour or so, of course that wasn't on the video, but after a period of time, they got out and tracked the dogs with the radio telemetry, and then shot the bear with an arrow, and the bear sat up in the tree and fell out of the tree after a few minutes. and as avid of as a hunter as I am, and I, you know, support everything in hunting, I think, except this. Someone will argue with me that baiting is unfair too, but in the case of baiting, Mr. Chairman and members, the bear comes to the bait and has the opportunity to smell the hunter, has opportunity to run, where once the bear is up in the tree, about the only thing the bear can do is leap from the tall tree to its own, you know, and be injured or killed in the leap, try and escape the dogs. But someone else, I'm just uncomfortable with that section, and I would like to make an oral amendment to remove it. Line 16 and 17.
Let's see. Representative Geo would...
15, 16, and 17, Mr. Chairman.
On which page?
What I'm trying to accomplish here is to remove the trailing of with the dog. Well, I'm trying to figure that out. Mr. Helen, can you help me with that, please?
Mr. Chair, members, then we would remove all of Section 17, lines 11 through 17.
Yeah, the motion is made to delete Section 17. It seems that these sections are not numbered sequentially. That's not a big deal, but as long as
Mr.
we know
Chair,
what we're doing on.
I think they're numbered to fit the existing bill because it's an amendment
okay.
Right.
To the existing bill.
Yeah, that's what's on. Okay, great. Thank you for that clarification.
Mr. Chairman, before we vote on that, I want to say that I'm very supportive of the bill. Just that one provision is the troubling provision for me. Also, I have heard from every bear licensed bear hunting operation in my district, which I have a few, and every bear hunting guide, I think, in my district that I know of, and each of them is against this provision and have communicated that to me. That said, I'm ready for the outcome.
Mm-hmm. Representative Hoppe?
I think we should vote.
Okay. Anyone else have any comments on the amendment to delete Section 17? Okay. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
Motion prevails.
Or, I mean, the other way. Sorry. Aye. Voted against my own base.
Prevailed. All the ayes were there anyway.
Yes.
Without you. So.
Please record me as an aye.
Okay. You don't get recorded, huh?
Okay.
Got me going.
Got me all shook up.
Any other...
freshman learning experience.
Mr. Chair?
I'm happy.
Mr. Chair, we did have Mr. Bogus just brought this to my attention, and I should have caught this earlier. On page 5, either line 17 or 18, depending on where you want to start, the provision on youth deer licenses has been addressed in earlier legislation. So that I'd like to strike everything from 17 to 29 because it's already been taken care of. It's no longer valid.
Okay. Deleting everything from line 17 to 29. Is that okay, Mr. Helen? Is there any additions or corrections?
On page 5.
Page 5. Okay, there was actually changing some existing language with regard to youth deer license. mm-hmm. and talking about archery and taking that out.
Yep, taking the whole section out. It's already been done, or it's already been addressed, I should say.
Okay. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Bill is amended. Okay, any other comments, questions, additions, or subtractions?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Dill.
I have another amendment. I'm going to try and do it right this time. It's the A041003 amendment, and it was drafted to the original bill 2368. So we're going to have Mr. Helen get this inserted correctly. So I think to do it at this moment, I think we need to strike line 2 and line 4 because it doesn't fit.
We can just give him directions, staff okay. directions to fit it properly. If you can explain your amendment.
Mr. Chairman, members, there is a situation where property owners in Minnesota, or non-resident property owners in Minnesota, are unable to trap on their own land. And this provision provides for a license for non-resident trappers. As you can see, starting on line 20, it says the non-resident may take small game by trapping only on land owned by non-residents if the non-resident possesses a trapping license and small game license. This is pretty straightforward. The DNR has indicated they're in concurrence on this, and it will remedy a problem. Where this amendment came from is from a few old-timers that been trapping all their life, lived up in northeastern Minnesota, in my district particularly, and move to Arizona or somewhere and then take up residency but still own land up in Minnesota and can't trap on it. So we'll sell them a license, we'll accept their money, help pay for those loop land problems we had earlier, and at least it'll be a few bucks. They can take a small game.
Okay, any questions on the amendment? Any comments from DNR or Representative Hoppe?
Mr. Chair, I think we would regard this as a friendly amendment, and we would like to remind Representative Dill to vote for this.
Yeah,
it would be an aye vote.
I'm going to try and get it right this time, Representative Hoppe. Yeah.
Mr. Bogus, you have some comments on this provision?
Mr. Chair and members, we've discussed this with Representative Dill, and we have no problems with this amendment.
Okay. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bogus, it makes reference to the trapping of small game, but isn't like a coyote is a non-game animal? So are the non-residents currently allowed to trap that just like a resident would, or how would a coyote fall in?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, coyotes are unprotected species, and there's no license required for anyone to hunt or trap them right now. So they can.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Bogus, so currently that's one of the few things that they would be able to trap.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, I'm trying to think how the law is worded, and I don't know if Mr. Helen can help me, but there's a law that doesn't allow non-residents to do something unless they're specifically licensed. So I guess I'm not sure that a resident does not need a license. I'm not sure if a non-resident actually could trap coyote under existing law. I'd have to double-check that.
Mr. Chair.
If we can, on that point, Mr. Bogus, if you could take a look at the amendment, because it also talks about, it has some non-resident language there. It may not take a raccoon, bobcat, fox, coyote, or Canadian lynx, and we're adding or inserting the words by firearms here. So it indicates that they can't take them now, and then, but this is really narrowing it down to just firearms. So evidently, you were correct that they can't currently trap them.
Mr. Chair, I believe that is correct. I'd have to dig through the statutes a little bit.
Okay. Representative Wozniak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Mr. Vargas, could you define unprotected birds for me? What is the effect of hunting unprotected birds? There's no season, there's no limit, is how I read that. But could you clarify that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Wasla, that's correct. For unprotected birds and unprotected mammals, there's basically no no limits. There are no restrictions on methods of take, no seasons, other than there are some restrictions on use of poisons and motor vehicles and things like that. But, you know, generally the most common types of unprotected birds that you might think about now are things like pigeons, sparrows, things like that are unprotected birds.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair, I was curious to see great horned owls on that list.
Mr. Chair and Representative Wass, look, yes, that's true. However, because they have federal protection, they're in a little bit different category because all hawks and owls are protected by federal law. So even though Minnesota statutes do not protect great horned owls, in the information that we provide to hunters, we indicate that great horned owls are a protected species under federal law, because if we didn't do that, they would be inadvertently violating federal law. So what it amounts to is to take a great horned owl, to legally take a great horned owl, you need a federal permit. You do not need a state permit.
Representative Lawson.
One additional, well, perhaps I'm wondering if it would make sense just to amend to strike great horned owl, be consistent with the federal law.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wozniak, where are you reading that?
I'm looking on the amendment, which was approved.
It's the first page of the amendment.
Line 16. Mr. Chair, I may be ahead of myself here. Has the Dill amendment been approved?
No, it has not. We're still on the...
So I am ahead.
I'm reading the wrong amendment. That's where I'm going.
I'm going where it is. Even I don't vote the right way.
We're... okay. Now I'm back. Now we are on the 1003 amendment.
Right. So everything I said, Mr. Chair, that after we vote on this...
Okay. We'll come back to you.
We'll go back to that.
Any other questions on the 1003 amendment? Okay. All in favor, signify by saying... Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this may have been a freshman moment, but the coyote.
Did, two in a row.
Did we get the coyote figured out? I missed it. If we did, I apologize.
Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara, I still have not found the citation in statute, but I believe the way that it works is that non-residents cannot take coyotes except as specifically authorized in the Game and Fish laws, which is only by hunting. There is.
Do you have a copy of the amendment up there at your table?
No, we do not.
Would somebody get the author a copy of the amendment, please? If you look at starting on line 14, I think there's the section that you're referring to, and they're changing that section to say that it is by firearms, so that the it would allow for trapping. Right now, it would be you just can't take them, period.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. That clarifies that existing law does allow it, and it's still by hunting, but this makes it clear that it's by firearms, because we are now providing a way that a non-resident could take them by trapping on their property. So under existing law, they could not take coyotes by trapping.
Okay. What about the, because this is now saying by firearms, and there's more than, let's see, evidently this will catch everyone that's a non-resident, because it says that non-residents can only take them on their own land, so that would mean if you're not on your own land, you wouldn't be able to take them, so that should, I guess that gets it covered. Just want to make sure we're not losing something in this process here. Any other questions on the amendment? Anyone that wanted to testify on the amendment? Okay. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Now we'll go back to Representative Wozniak. We have incorporated into the bill Amendment 1084, and you were referring to something in that provision that you wanted to address.
Correct, Mr. Chair, and I think Representative McNamara's second freshman moment got me confused when he was talking about protected mammals. and I saw the provision on, or excuse me, on unprotected mammals, and I saw the provision on unprotected birds, and I was curious about the great horned owl, and wondering if it makes sense to strike that from the language.
Mr. Bossing?
Mr. Chair and members.
I'll get it right yet.
Don't worry about it, Mr. Chair. It's been pronounced in very many ways.
It's been a stressful week, trust me.
Mr. Chair, I don't know that the department would have any real issue with that one way or the other. It's been something that's been on the books for a long time, but because the federal government protects great horned owls, we tell hunters that they are protected. The only thing that it would do is it would require, right now there are provisions in statute for operators of game farms and poultry farms to remove great horned owls that are causing damage. They have to get a federal permit. They have to follow specific requirements for how they capture those great horned owls. And right now, the state does not have to get involved in the issuance of the permits for those operations. If we strike great horned owls from the list of unprotected birds, then we would also have to issue state permits for those poultry farms and game farms. So there would be some additional work by the state that we would have to do. And I think it's working. Most of the public does not read the statute books. They read the information that we provide them that tells them what's legal. And so I think the current situation is working.
Thank you for that clarification.
Any other questions on House File 2368 as amended?
Mr. Chair, I did read through the amendment. I did not read through for this committee the bill 2368, this year's Game and Fish. If you'd like me to, I can run through these provisions.
We had that in
we had it in policy.
Is there any questions that members have or desire for us to go through that bill? Because we've had that testimony before. Okay. Hearing no objection, we will proceed. House File 2368, we recommend to pass as amended and referred to the General Register.
Mr. Chair, after consulting with Representative Hackbarth and Mr. Bogus, I think we might now have to send this bill to Ways and Means because of some of the provisions, the changing of license requirements in 2368. And Representative Dill's trapping might have some Ways and Means implications now.
Okay.
And just not to run afoul of anybody, we might want to see if they want to see it. No pun intended.
Yeah, right. Representative Cash.
Chairman, is there a fiscal note on the change in age in the hunting licenses?
Mr. Chair and Representative Kahn, there is not yet.
Why is this committee hearing it without a fiscal note?
Well, I think that the in answer to that, I don't know. That's a good question. We'll get a fiscal note for it. I think maybe that the answer was the change is not going to be a substantial amount of money.
How do you know?
You're very wise with your counsel, Representative Kahn. We will have a fiscal note done immediately, if not sooner.
We had, I believe, when we were in policy committee, had similar questions and asked for it to be referred here. In checking with DNR, it was my understanding that there was no real impact on the bill that originally entered into the committee. But now with a couple of the amendments on it, that has been expanded. So we'll send this to Ways and Means, and then they'll get the fiscal note at that time. Okay. Is there any further questions on House File 2368? Okay, the motion prevails to send this to Ways and Means. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, member.
We'll now go to Representative Olson, House File 2040. Welcome to committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Olson, I'll move your bill, House File 2040. And this will go to, let's see, this goes to General Register.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Olson.
Mr. Chair, members, House File 2040 has two basic purposes here. One, the first is a bill from Representative Howes that was rolled in the Policy Committee. It amends the Warrantied Systems Statute, allowing for different sections, different length of sections of piping to be used. This is a change that's needed because of new technologies. I have here today in the audience Jerry Seck with the Infiltration Systems, if there's questions on that when we get to questions. But the PCA approves of that, and everybody is on board. The second part, which is the much longer part, involves creating a process for approval for advanced septic system technologies. In particular, it's a separation technology. We have biodigester and water reclamation systems. We define black water and gray water. Black water is your water from the toilet and kitchen waste, any urinals in a home. And the gray water would be any other waste besides the black water waste. So it's complete separation of the two technologies, or excuse me, complete separation of the two, creating two waste streams and using different technologies to treat it. This technology and the separation process involves bringing us to a point where we have a zero. We can have a zero discharge of pollution. The treatment levels can reach that point where there's no discharge of pollution. So you have a variety of systems available under this process. The gray water, if it's discharged above ground or for use in the house, must reach the health risk limits for drinking water, and if it's discharged outside and or underground, must reach the MPCA water quality rules. The black water must be treated to the levels described in federal standards for sewage sludge, and there's an exemption from the plumbing code, notwithstanding one provision on page 4, line 9. I'd like to connect that for you. Toilets that do not contain a standard integral water trap must have a water-sealed mechanical valve. This addresses the one major concern with existing codes that has prevented this system from being approved all over the state. So the plumbing code is exempted, except we create a code for this system by requiring a water-sealed mechanical trap. There's a manufacturer certification process. This involves a third-party testing documentation to be submitted to the agency, and that would be to certify that all applicable state standards for above or below surface discharge for potable water are met. The manufacturer must also provide training that's approved by the commissioner, and that's to provide certification for people to install, maintain, operate, and monitor these systems. There's a fee not to exceed $4,000 for this process to the commissioner, and there's requirements in the bill starting on page 5 for manufacturer consumer participation. Only trained and certified persons may install, operate, repair, maintain, or monitor these systems. Owners, however, cannot monitor these systems, and that's a measure for accountability. Approval requirements may also include some additional requirements from the local unit of government. These, however, must be approved and are subject to the commissioner's approval. Beyond that, if a local unit of government does not initiate any action, all of the requirements that are met would be through the commissioner. Any subsurface discharge or surface discharge must meet MPCA rules for septic systems. And the agency may either issue an individual or general permit to regulate these discharges, and that's a measure for addressing costs. The general permits, which involve a number of systems to be approved under them, would reduce the costs to the owners of these systems. I also have with me here at the table Clint Elston from Aquarius. The this language will provide approval for a number of different possible systems, some I know in development. But the most commonly known system is the Aquarius system that originated in Alaska. And I'm going to hand out these cards here that he has because it gives you a basic picture of the technology that can go inside of the a room in the basement, like a furnace room, a mechanical room, or in a vault outside the house. This technology, members, let me just describe the concept of how it works, and then I'll turn it over for questions. There's two aspects to it. The biodigester side of this is what treats the black water. It represents a composting tank that is aerated and a red worm culture process to turn all the waste into composting. The gray water side of this involves a variety of technologies: aeration, ozone, filtration, ultraviolet light, and reverse osmosis. If all of these are used, you reach a zero discharge capacity. If you don't use all of these, if you just simply separate, use the biodigester, you could end up with a system that requires subsurface discharge but no septic tank. So there can be a cost savings to this, to the homeowner, when these systems are used. Often that can occur, especially when you're in unique situations where you don't have room for a complete system that exists today, or mound systems that can get to be very expensive. If you have questions for Mr. Elston, he's here and can take your questions now. He wasn't here at the last meeting before the policy committee, and I'll hand out these cards and we'll leave it for questions now.
Mr. Chairman, I have an amendment to the bill which I've discussed, but before that, the question of the red worms came up. Isn't there a problem with some worms being exotic species that are causing problems in our ecosystem? And I just wondered if someone would say, are these worms okay, or is there some way to stop, or if they aren't, is there some way to govern what kind of worms we use?
My name is Clint Elston, and I'm the president of Aquarius Corporation. Mr. Chair and Representative, to answer the question in regards to worms, basically the composting process is a Mother Nature's situation. And the involvement of adding the red worms to them, and actually we use a very small white worm also involved in it, is
the question is, are those worms exotic species in Minnesota or not? You're sure? Because the DNR has said that. Because we are having problems with worms in the northern forests.
That's correct. These worms are red worms. They're called manure worms. They're not exotic.
Mr. Chairman, just because we're used to seeing them around doesn't mean they're not. I'm just asking if you've had that. This has become a problem in northern Minnesota. It has become a problem because of fisher anglers discarding what they consider to be ordinary worms and multiplying. And I just wonder. And there are certain worms that are a problem and certain worms that aren't a problem. And I just want to know if you've checked that out.
Mr. Chair, Representative, to be truthful about it, I haven't checked that out. But in Mother Nature's aspect of doing the composting process and in this tank, there's not ever been a problem.
Mr. Chair.
Well, I don't think we had ever, Mr. Chairman, I don't think we had ever thought there was a problem with anglers taking their worms that were used and just dumping them. And now there is an enormous problem in the forests of northern Minnesota. So, and this isn't, I don't know how long other people knew about it. I've only heard about it within the last couple of years. So clearly anything that puts more worms into the area is, no matter how much of a, these worms are just doing what they're supposed to do, this natural thing, and it's totally destroying the subsurface. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative Cotton, I appreciate your question. It's a good one. We do know one thing, that these worms do an exotic job. It's very unusual. But beside that, we can certainly check that out. I don't know where Mr. Elston gets the worms, what the source is, and how it started. But that may lead to, I'm just thinking aloud here, that may lead to an answer to your question. But we can certainly check that out. I hadn't had that question before, and it's a good one, and I hadn't heard about that problem before. But I am becoming more aware of a lot of things serving on the LCMR and the Environment Policy Committee. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, then the next thing, I've already discussed this with Representative Olson and with you, is I'd like to move an amendment. I don't know exactly how it fits into the bill, but an amendment that that Representative that Mr. Helen prepared a while ago for me when I was looking into this issue. This is, and I'm going to have to make a little amendment to fit the systems that Representative Olson wants. But we have a source of money that we've never used, and it's only recently become available to use. And this is money that's in the principal of the Environmental Trust Fund. And we could only use it when the principal got over a certain amount, which I think it has only recently done. And it's only for loans, it's not for grants, and it's a low-interest loan, although the calculations in the law are too complicated for me to tell you exactly what it would be. Now, this was allowed in the constitutional amendment for the Environmental Trust Fund. The only thing it wasn't allowed for was municipal sewage sewage treatments, which this clearly isn't. LCMR discussed this when we were doing our plan, using the ability to use this kind of money, and we decided that we didn't want to use it because the problem was so huge that we decided should we use it for septic tank problems. The problem was so huge that they just couldn't see that we could make much of a dent in it with the amount of funds that would be available. And I don't remember what the number is. It's not a huge amount of money. That 5% is not a huge. I have it somewhere, but I didn't bring it with me. But it seemed to me this is an experimental program, and to put a source of funding, which isn't a grant, it's a loan, and to see if we can use this section of money was a good idea to attach it to Representative Olson's bill, and he's interested in it. The only thing we need to do to fit his bill is that it's likely that individuals, not local units of government, will want to do it. So we have to add, reading in that first paragraph, where we say is to offer below market interest loans to local units of government, we'd have to add or individuals. And if that's contradicted by something else, then you'd have to do something where the local unit of government stayed at. So I'd like to amend this amendment by adding or individuals in that first paragraph of it.
Mr. Chair? Do we have the amendment? Yes. I'm sorry. Thank you.
The bottom portion of the letter is actually drafted as an amendment.
Okay. And again, this doesn't mean that we'll use it, but it gives an alternative. It gives a kind of a positive incentive for people to possibly try this system. And as it goes through the process, we'll see if this language works or if it needs to be tweaked. What?
Mr. Chair and Representative Kahn, where were you going to add and individuals?
It looked in the first paragraph where it says below to local units of government. We want to add or individuals.
Okay, thank you.
And you know, it may end up not being useful, but it's just being put out on the table so it is available. And it would have no effect on the amount of money that we'd have available for our LCMR distribution.
And where is this? How would this be set up?
I don't know. People figure it out.
What we're doing is providing for authorization
yes.
of the language. And then Mr. Valine, could maybe you come up and give me a little insight as to how this would work, how it would...
He's the one person I didn't talk to.
So. Mr. Chair, to the finance point, we also have Gretchen Sable here with PCA if there's any questions along that line. And the fiscal note came out with a net, no net increase. There are costs, but there's no net.
We passed out the fiscal notes. So we'll talk about that in just a minute. We're checking with Ways and Means right now to find out what they would like to do with this.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'm John Valine, the Director for the Legislative Commission on Minnesota Resources. I believe the question is the implementation of the constitutional allowance to give loans and what the effects would be.
How would that, which, as I understand it, what Representative Kahn is proposing is to change the statutory language to allow for more flexible use of the of this authorized, loaned authorized provisions. And I'm wondering as to, first of all, your opinion on that, but secondly, if it was, if we did adopt this, how would such a program be implemented? Through LCMR, or is it, how does that, how would that work?
Mr. Chair, a lawyer would say you're asking for speculation, because the statute is silent on how it would work.
No, it didn't.
In terms of which the Public Facilities Authority is named in the current statute.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a technique pointed out there where it's 5% of the principal of the trust fund. The current trust fund market value is, I don't know, I think I heard it was a couple months ago, $317 million, something like that. That fluctuates with the marketplace. And for the purposes of the trust fund allowable expenditures, we have to look at the value on June 30th of the even-numbered year. And that is the date, whatever that corpus is, corpus value is on that date. That's the value that the LCMR and the legislature uses in terms of appropriating money for the following biennium. So this being an even-numbered year, I guess June 30th, the LCMR will know what the corpus value is for those purposes. I don't know what date you would pick for the corpus value for this purpose. Presuming it's the same, let's just assume for the moment that it's the same. And presuming that the corpus value is in the vicinity of $300 million, then a 5% provision would be about $15 million worth of loan money. Representative Kahn is correct that the current, the statute that was drawn in 1980, I think it was 1987, the way the statute was drawn then, during a relatively high interest rate experience, is very convoluted, but effectively it amounts to a negative interest rate the way it's constructed. I can't even articulate it. I've looked at it several times, and I've talked to the Public Facilities Authority people, and they say, well, if prevailing interest rates are in the vicinity of 4 or 5%, then this formula that's in the law would get you down to around 1, 1.25, 1.5, depending on what the prevailing interest rates are. In today's prevailing interest rate period, I think you'd go to zero pretty quickly, depending on what the rates are. But that does, those rates fluctuate, as does the corpus of the trust fund. Now, I'm trying to wander back to the questions you were asking, if you wouldn't mind.
Well, the question is that, to me, the language that she has, not only would open it up to a program such as what Representative Olson has in his bill, but it would also allow for loans for septic systems. And I'm wondering who would make that determination and how would that be? How do you narrow down the scope of this? Because the language that we have before us is very broad. I'm assuming that would not be, that's not how this would get enforced, though. Regulated, so somebody has to make those decisions. Does that fall underneath the LCMR? Is that another statutory provision that needs to be established? What's the process?
Mr. Chair,
maybe you have insight as to.
Since I've looked at it longer than anyone else, I don't have a lot of information, but I have at least some more opinions. First of all, nothing happens unless the commission votes to do it. So, you know, this is such a minor first step that I think we're just putting it out to let people look at it. The next thing is the commission must adopt a procedure for the issuance of them by the Public Facilities Authority. I would not want to see the commission get into any real judgment on that. But I think the Public Facilities Authority could. And I think that, if we decided to vote to do this, or if people want to even tighten this up, well, if we decide that we want to vote to do this, I think they would then, what I would do as a member of the commission, what I would suggest is to put the whole thing into the public hands of the Public Facilities Authority. Okay. And then let them put out an RFP project. And one of the things they can do is they can put restrictions on it. Like Representative McNamara came and said, well, could small businesses do this? You know, and I think they could if someone says later that we need to amend the language even further to make sure that small businesses could do it, that they could do it. If we want to go to low interest instead of interest-free, this is all in statute, so we can change those language. We can change that language to make it no interest instead of interest-free. It is a loan. It's not a grant, so it does have less... No, but I think that Representative Olson has come with something that ought to be tried. I've looked at several places at different, not one like this, but I've seen even less complicated biodigester systems that I've wished that we'd put in some, in you know, isolated places where there aren't systems. And I just think we should do what we can to encourage it. And I would say adding this language is really just opening people up to this possibility of being able to do this. And it's so many steps from being done that I don't think we have to worry that the language isn't perfect or that the financing doesn't perfectly work.
Representative Hackworth.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Kahn, issuance of, purpose of water impairment improvement loans is pretty broad, I think, and it's not perfect language, and I think it makes it very, very broad in what this could be used for. It's not going to be just for innovative septic systems, etc. This could open it up to just about any kind of impaired waters. And I think this is something that we might want to look a little more at before we stick this on Representative Olson's bill. This is, I don't think we should go there, Mr. Chairman.
Mm-hmm. President Kahn, I would suggest that we lay your amendment over for further consideration by this committee and see what we can work. We have other vehicles that we can use to, if we're able to work out some agreements, is what we really think is the best way, but this has enough implications and going in a different direction. I'd really prefer not to do this on an amendment on a bill that is, really has a totally different purpose. But because it is guidance with regard to fiscal concerns, we have other vehicles that we can attach this to at a later time, and this gives us an opportunity to work on it.
I'm just pointing out, Mr. Chairman, it doesn't have to, when I saw this bill, it seemed that it was a useful place to put it.
Yeah.
I'm pointing out, Mr. Chairman, that the ability to put $15 million that's not being used anywhere else in the state into cleaning up waters, if you look at it with respect to bonding, you're really, if we just, throwing just without accurate calculations, you're getting 100 times the effectiveness of, say, using, if you do it, you get 10, let's just say 10 times. If we put this into the Environmental Trust Fund, then we get to use roughly the interest from that, which is roughly about 10%. So if we use it before we put it in, we've made that money 10 times more effective. If we ever wanted to use it for bonding, we'd make it 100 times more effective. So to do something where we say that cleaning up the impaired waters in the state is very important. This is just a much better use of money than anything else that we're looking at. It gives us and it doesn't take money from anything else that we're doing. It takes a very small amount of money from the Environmental Trust Fund in future bienniums. Because you make that calculation, you wouldn't, I would assume whatever you do, is that you'd make that calculation and then you'd set this money, you'd go to that date that you decide what it's 5% and then this would happen after that. So you wouldn't reduce that and,
Mr. Chair, with the, I think what we're going to do is that Representative Kahn has agreed to withdraw this amendment this time. We'll carry this discussion on and try to see what we can come up with for future. We're reaching our time limit here. Like to, and Representative Kahn withdraws her amendment. House File 2040 is before us. Any other questions on the bill? The bill, we've checked with Ways and Means, Representative Olson. They do want to see your bill. And so we will. The motion will be to recommend House File 2040 pass and be referred to Ways and Means. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very quickly, while this was going on, we conferred a bit with others, and to represent Kahn's question on the worms, they are basically purchased on the open market currently, so I'm trusting that they are worms that are acceptable. But the worms are light sensitive and they're never released from the system, hoping that helps address some of your concerns. Mr. Chair, if it's even preferred, and I know I need to be sensitive to the other part of the bill, if it's even preferred that what Representative Kahn is suggesting go with this bill, I'd be amenable to holding this over as well until all that could be worked out. What she's suggesting is very helpful, but it sounds like we probably should go on to Ways and Means and keep working on what she's suggesting for other measures.
Looking at timelines, I suggest you move your bill.
I will.
Out of here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
House File 2040 is recommended to pass and referred to Ways and Means. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Bill is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Members, I think that takes care of our agenda for today, and we come back Tuesday. We have nothing before next Tuesday. We are adjourned.